If you're looking for the perfect gift, you're covered with a gift that's sure to wow. Taste of Chicago ships Lou Malnati's legendary deep dish pizzas nationwide. Plus, they ship other Windy City favorites too. Visit tastesofchicago.com to order today.
Wintrust Business Lunch. John Williams, producer Pete, and your friend Elise Glink are all here. She's the owner of Think Glink Media and bestmoneymoves.com. Another big day on the markets today, Elise.
Oh, my goodness. We're seeing record highs across the board just about. NASDAQ's the only, I would say, laggard, but it's just a few hundred points behind its all-time record. So, and yeah, people of equities, doing. You're probably happy today.
If 44 was the question on the Dow, now it's 45. That's, you know, that Dr. Frelick, who came on with Terry Savage and me to talk about his prediction of 44,000 on the Dow at year's end, which seemed to be insane. He's going to be wrong again this year. He's going to be on the low side at this rate. Who knew?
Yeah, it's now looking like if this kind of trend continues, we're going to see 50,000 before too long on the Dow, which was a number. Do you remember that book or that guy that wrote that book, Dow at 30,000 or Dow at 35,000? Doesn't that seem like a long time ago?
No kidding. Well, is this all just because of the new Treasury Secretary? What is his name? Bessent?
Scott Bessent. Yeah, this was a kind of a surprise pick for Donald Trump. He's a hedge fund owner. Maybe that's not so surprising. Another part of the Billionaires Club, I believe. Owner of Key Square Group. That's a position he'll need to resign if he decides to go through with this. But I think the markets and what I'm seeing online is that he is a huge supporter of equity markets. He may try to mitigate some of Trump's extremist policies, things like tariffs everywhere, right? Which I think a lot of business owners were very worried about. But they also think that he'll be supportive of extending the tax cuts. We've got some big tax issues coming up at the end of 2025 that need to be dealt with. And so they're buying into the idea, lower taxes, less regulation, good for business.
Yeah, those tax cuts that went into place in 2017 are set to expire at the end of 2025. So the question is, are we going to let those expire? And is that an increase in taxes or just the end of tax rate forgiveness? But either way, taxes could go up for some wage earners in 2025. Trump, I think, says that he's going to continue with the tax cuts on businesses and high-end wage earners, right?
Oh, I think that's his plan. And that's one of the reasons why I think it was something like 23 or 25 Nobel Prize-winning economists said, hey, there's a lot of debt that's going to come into play here. But I think there are very few people who want to pay estate taxes, and that's one of the things that's expiring.
Estate taxes.
Yeah. Estate taxes are one, and then also just the way that we pay federal income taxes. So, yeah, I think Trump is planning on keeping tax rates low. I think that Republicans in general are in favor of deregulation, and that is typically good for businesses, particularly businesses with a lot of regulation, the food industry, the energy industry, things to watch out for.
Yeah. The strategies column in the Times today talks about some of these ideas. For instance, the total U.S. debt right now is 123% of GDP. Think about that. If your income is $100,000 a year, then your debt would be $123,000. So you're making a lot of money, but you're upside down to the tune of $23,000 or $123,000. The total U.S. debt to GDP, our debt is 123% of our gross domestic product. That's a troubling high number, and yet equities surge forward.
Yeah, I mean, I just say that there are differences, tremendous differences between a country having debt and, an individual having that much debt.
I can't print money, and we can. But just one other observation from that piece, and then I want to talk to you about some of these real estate trends you are also noticing. But they also said that if Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy are going to cut federal spending and whittle away at our debt. And $2 trillion is nonsense. But whatever, if they're going to actually make an impact, it's going to be hard for them to do because the incoming president said that we're not going to touch Social Security, Medicare, or defense spending. And if you don't touch those three sacred cows, then you're going to have a hard time finding noticeable or appreciable savings, right?
That's exactly right. There are not a lot of places to cut this budget. And if you look at what's going on in the world right now, our defense spending is actually going to increase. We need to protect our armed forces. We need to project a strong force in the world. We're sending lots of stuff over to Ukraine right now and to Israel. So there's definitely not going to be any cuts in defense.
So, you know, just two areas where you are seeing their stock values appreciate, besides the market in general, but two interesting areas, again, anticipating a new administration. One is the company that sells fluoride to dentists. Their stock has gone up because maybe we'll have less fluoride in the water. People will want it on their teeth. So the company that sells that to dentists, their stock is up. Crypto, not surprisingly, is up. And the private sector companies that provide prison services. If you are in the business of providing, prison care, that is, I don't know that these are whole massive big prisons or just temporary places to house prisoners. But if we're going to start rounding people up, detaining them and then shipping them off, the stock for those companies are also on the up. How about that?
I wonder if the stock for the airlines that are going to be ferrying these people back to wherever they came from is also going to be up.
All those buses from Texas. Those Greyhound is probably going to see a swing, too. Talking to Elise Glink on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We, a moment ago, just talked about some of the economy numbers. Markets are up, and it seems like at least Wall Street likes what's happening with some of Trump's appointees. Talk to me about the real estate market and what are you noticing there?
Well, first of all, the bond market isn't as thrilled as everybody else in the equities market, which is kind of interesting, which is why we're seeing interest rates still up over 6%. And if you look at some of the forecasts that are now coming out from places like the National Association of Realtors and Zillow and Realtor.com, they're all looking for interest rates to stay over 6 and maybe even 6.5% all the way through 2026. And so that's going to make for a very bumpy housing market next year. And we're certainly not seeing anywhere close to the numbers we should be seeing for home sales. And that's a problem, as we all know, because, you know, when you're selling the same number of homes that you were selling, say, 30 years ago, that's a problem. I mean, in 2025, we were selling homes at an adjusted rate of about $7.25 million a year. That was 19 years ago. The U.S. population was under 300 million. Today, we're selling 4 million on a good year. And we've got 345 million people. So you can see where the problems lie. And I think in these forecasts, you're seeing them acknowledge that these are structural problems and they're not sure how it's going to be resolved.
Structural problems, meaning on the supply side?
Yeah, not enough houses, right? I mean, even at 6%, I think you'd have people buying houses if they weren't as expensive as they are, which they are because there are very few houses to buy. I mean, when you look at the National Association of Realtors just came out with their 2024 migration trends. This is an annual report that they do that look at where people are moving in the country and what the key motivators are for people who are moving. And the South, Southwest, and Southeast is still the top destination. But the reasons why, I think, is sort of interesting, right? I mean, people are moving for cheaper housing. They're moving to get more money out, more house for their money. They're, looking for outdoor space. They want a quieter area, you know, things like that. And, you know, in the South, you get cheaper housing, you get more of it for your money. Still the case here in this country.
But didn't that survey also say that the single number one reason people move, or the reason they move to some place, is to be close to family, right?
Yeah, no question about it. And as younger people migrate further south, their older parents seem to be following along, right? Or the other way, where you had, you know, older people moving to the south for the better weather, which, by the way, didn't really come up when I looked at the data in that relocation survey. It wasn't, or I should say migration survey. You know, we think about the south as having great weather, or at least some parts of the south having great weather. It can get a little wet, as we've seen this year. But that weather didn't come up as much. It's really being closer to friends and family and getting more house for the money, which was, I thought, fascinating.
And taxes are a complaint here in Illinois. There's a lot of reasons not to live in Illinois, although there are actually some tax advantages. But people are tired of the politics. They're tired of the property tax rates or the sales tax rates in the cities. They're done with Illinois. They say, I'm leaving. I can't afford it. I can't take it anymore. That's cited often as a reason that people leave Illinois, right?
Yeah, it is. And for seniors, actually, Illinois ranks in the top, I think, 10 or 11 states for people who are seniors and retiring here. It's a good spot to retire because your retirement money doesn't get taxed. Yes, you do have higher sales tax, but as you age, you tend to buy a little bit less, right? So there's pluses and minuses everywhere. But in the South, people really like, you know, business owners like the lower tax rates. They like sales tax that seems to be magically disappearing, right? The South tends to get a lot of revenue from vacationers from around the world. So one of the reasons that Florida can afford to have no sales tax is they've got a very high hotel tax, which you may have paid having visited Disney, for example.
I have not, but that's, and you would know about that, right?
Yeah, it definitely helps when you've got a ton of people flying in and then staying at hotels and eating out in restaurants. All of that tax goes to help support what's going on in Florida and Arizona and other places that are sort of in the Sun Belt, where we don't get that as much up here in Chicago.
All of that said, the U.S. Census Bureau says, you've shared this with us, that the highest net migration in 2024 isn't over, but more folks moved to this state than any other state. It's Florida, 372,000 net migration. Does that mean they gained 372,000 by people moving from the other 49 states?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct. And Texas wasn't too far behind at 315,000. Followed by, and you'll notice the big drop, North Carolina, 126,000, South Carolina, 91,000, Georgia, 88,000, Tennessee, 76,000. You know, it's the same thing, Arizona, Alabama. And then you finally get to a state that's not in the Sun Belt, Oklahoma, of all places, 31,000, where the cost of living is extremely reasonable.
Right.
And then you get some of the sort of Midwest, Ohio, Indiana kind of states. But fascinating that Florida and Texas are so far above everyone else, all the other states, when it comes to that net migration numbers. Those states are growing.
And the ability to work at home is not a driving factor in this, is it?
Yeah, no, it was interesting. Only 2% of the National Association of Realtors' recent clients made their move due to a return to office requirement in their job. In the Midwest, it was 4%. So a few more people in the North who required over normal. And job location is not a big part of this either. And that's, I think, what you're getting at. 43% of recent home buyers are working remotely. If you have to be part-time in the office, 37% of people considered that.
Elise Glink, the owner of ThinkLink Media and Best Money Moves. You can click on thinklink.com for information like this. Nice to talk to you. Thank you, Elise.
Always, John.
Jim Dahlke is the Director of Communications at TechNexus Venture Collaborative. He joins us on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
So where should we start today? You want to talk about food? You want to talk about startups? I know we can marry the two. Where should we begin?
Yeah, you know, let's talk about a funding round from a really interesting Chicago startup called Synapticure. This is a really remarkable Chicago startup, not just for its mission that it's working on, but also the founders behind it. The startup is led by Brian Wallach and his wife, Sandra, Brian was diagnosed with ALS back in 2017 and is thankfully still with us today. Of course, the average lifespan with someone diagnosed with ALS is just 3 years. It's a really grim diagnosis. So this is really making Brian's story truly a remarkable one. And the company he's behind is called SynaptiCure, and it's a telehealth platform for people living with ALS and other neurodegenerative disorders. Really, it kind of its main selling point here is this telehealth platform that connects patients to neurologists much faster than they would with an in-person visit. An average wait time for a neurologist can take months, up to 4 to 6 months, in fact, where SynaptiCure can get you in front of a neurologist in a matter of weeks. So that's really a major selling point for this company, which just raised $25 million in new funding, bringing its total funding raised to about $40 million. Google is an investor in this company as well, which is a great vote of confidence for this really emerging health tech platform here in Chicago.
But it connects them to a physician. It doesn't mean the physician's now going to have a cure or treatment. This isn't a drug. This isn't a procedure. It's just a network. Is that it?
Yeah, and it's better access to care. One of their also main selling points is having this sort of personal care navigator. So each patient, each caregiver is going to have a dedicated nurse or social worker that works with them to help coordinate really everything they need, from support to education, and kind of really be that advocate for them. And it connects patients to clinical trials as well. So it's neurologists and care navigators, what they say, they take the time to really discuss the priorities with patients and reviewing different clinical trials that are available. So it's not a new drug or not a new cure necessarily, but really just better access to care and faster access to care.
Well, I can just imagine that for people who are diagnosed or wonder if they have one of those illnesses, how frustrating it must be to not get in front of a human being and to talk to them and say, what do I do? What's happening to me? Whenever we have a conversation like this, Jim, I also imagine a scenario where the person on the other end is ChatGPT. I wonder if artificial intelligence will fill in some of these gaps.
Certainly, AI is just playing a role in a lot of healthcare, especially on the kind of chat front, but what SynaptiCure really wants to do is connect you with those humans too, right? So I don't think that AI is going to play, the majority of the role for companies like this, but may certainly play a supporting role. And definitely encourage folks to check out Brian Wallach's story. He's got a documentary that they've made. He's been on the Today Show, profiled in the New York Times. Really remarkable story and certainly an inspiring story of a Chicago entrepreneur.
Zarmanali Health launches. Am I saying that right? Zarmanali?
Yeah, it's a bit of a mouthful to say, but Zarmanali Health. This is another interesting funding round here in Chicago. This is a startup that's creating a multi-specialty group that wants to change how pediatric care is provided. They just raised $40 million in a new seed fund. Essentially, what they are doing is creating new pediatric practices in an effort to better coordinate care, both at the primary care level and also the specialty care level. This was launched by a founder who had a child that had an autoimmune disorder and really noticed that, across the care that his child was receiving, these doctors just were not coordinating, they were not communicating. And so what this startup is aiming to do is kind of create a practice that better coordinates care really across the spectrum there. So they launched their first practice earlier this month and expect to be or hope to be in the 30 most populated states over the next 3 years. So $40 million in a seed round is going to help them hopefully try to do that.
What's this Pi company?
Yeah, Pi is a Chicago-based app for making friends. This sounds kind of like a San Francisco startup, but it's actually a Chicago-based business led by Andy Dunn, the former founder of Bonobos. He relocated back to his hometown, Chicago, to launch this business. And the startup is actually expanding to San Francisco. We see a lot of consumer apps begin their journeys in the Bay Area and then migrate over to Chicago eventually. This is kind of having the reverse effect, right? Launching first in Chicago and now expanding to San Francisco. This startup has raised $24 million, which is pretty significant for a Chicago consumer app in terms of the amount of funding raised. What's different about Pi is that, the approach they're taking for growing users on its platform is this creator fund that they've developed. They're investing $1 million into this fund that basically pays folks to host their events on their Pi platform. So one of the creators on the Pi app, you know, hosts these Sunday kind of workout events, you know, doing yoga or volleyball on the beach. You know, and the Andy Dunn, the founder, says that this person is making up to $100,000 a year by being active and hosting events on this platform. And so we'll see if they can continue to take off and expand outside of Chicago. But San Francisco next on the list for Pi.
Well, I'm glad that that is there. That sounds like a good idea. Jim Dahlke, Director of Communication at TechNexus Venture Collaborative. Have a good holiday, Jim. We'll talk next week.
Thanks, John. You too.
Let's keep you posted on the Wintrust Business Lunch now. More news from Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Northwestern Memorial Hospital is at the top of a list of Chicago's largest hospitals. The new ranking by Crain's shows Northwestern with $2.5 billion in net patient revenue in 2023, a 9% increase over the previous year. The University of Chicago Medical Center comes in second with $2.4 billion in revenue, up 10% over 2022. Rush University Medical Center is third with $2.3 billion in revenue. Advocate Illinois Medical Center recorded the biggest increase in revenue with a more than 16% jump. Endeavor Health recorded the biggest drop in revenue, down nearly 10%. The ranking shows the top 25 hospitals saw net patient revenue rise year over year by 7.5%. The acquisition of Chicago-based True Value by Do It Best has been completed. The sale price was $153 million. Do It Best will get all 4,000 stores, inventory, and brand rights. Do It Best says it will operate True Value as a subsidiary and will keep an office in Chicago. The company has also extended job offers to 500 corporate workers at True Value. The status of the other corporate employees is unknown. True Value filed for bankruptcy protection 6 weeks ago. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Now the business of food. Here's Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And you're about to thank me because I have a hack for making mashed potatoes ahead of time. After I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today, there's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDriveChicago.com. Oh, do I have a treat for you today? And by you, I mean the person in charge of making mashed potatoes for Thanksgiving dinner. At our house, the mashed potato person is Diane Montiel, who did me the huge favor of marrying me a long time ago.
Steve told me about this recipe.
Make ahead mashed potatoes.
It's a game changer. It took so much stress from that day.
A day that's already chaotic as guests are arriving and there you are, boiling potatoes.
Steam from the hot water will do lots of wonderful things to your hair. It can curl it up if you have curly hair. It can make your hair fall if you have straight hair. And it also gives you a facial. At that point, you don't want because you've already put your makeup on for the day.
I got the recipe from a Chicago friend, Ann Wright, who, as recipes go, got it from someone else.
And she said, oh, I have a great recipe that you can make ahead. And I was like, oh my God, tell me more. And so she sent it to me, and it was just the best thing. It was so nice to be able to make it a couple of days ahead, even the night before.
And after all the mashing and mixing, you put it in the fridge, and then on the day of Thanksgiving, when it's time to serve, you pull it out, put it in the microwave.
True mashed potato fans are very skeptical when you say, oh, you can just microwave them, and it's going to taste the same, but it really does.
There are variations of the recipe, and another friend of ours, the late Nova Langtry, got her make-ahead mashed potato recipe more than 20 years ago from her mother-in-law. It was in a fundraising cookbook for St. Attractive in Cicero.
It's a mashed potato casserole. It's like, are you kidding me? Because as Diane said, making mashed potatoes on the day you're serving dinner, it just complicates entertaining.
Both recipes are posted at WGNradio.com. Search for The Business of Food. Any last words, Diane?
It's magic, and we get complimented all the time on our mashed potatoes.
They are so good. On the food calendar, today is National Parfait Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of make-ahead mashed potatoes on 720 WGN.
Seems like seldom do we have a conversation here we don't mention AI, particularly on the Wintrust Business Lunch. A new study is shedding light on who uses AI, how often, and where. Trevor Wagoner is here, the chief economist and director of research center at the Computer and Communication Industry Association. So, Trevor, it sounds like you work with a trade organization for the computer industry, and you guys did a survey on how often we're using ChatGPT or other AI models. Is that right?
That's right. We surveyed ordinary consumers and workers just to see how users were engaging with AI and how those preferences with respect to devices had developed in light of the rising popularity of AI.
How often are we using it?
Workers and consumers have both taken to AI tools like a fish to water. 39% of all consumers are using AI tools for work and productivity use cases several times a week, while 47% of workers are doing so every single day. And 74% of workers say that AI will increase, their AI usage will be increasing over the next 5 years.
I was at an event not that long ago. The Chicago Tribune sponsored a workplace awards event. I was the MC, and there the guest speaker said to the assembled, "You are not going to be replaced by AI in the next 3 years, but you will be replaced by somebody who is using AI, so you'd better get on board." I suppose you subscribe to that.
I do. So I do think that AI looks like it will be a labor-augmenting device, not a labor-replacing device, which is to say that you can't necessarily replace an enormous number of workers with AI because you need a human in the loop. AI tools can save a lot of time. They do a lot of tasks very, very well. But they can make errors, which are often called hallucinations. And as a result, you do need a human subject matter expert in the loop.
Can you give me an example of how frequently it's being used? That is, in what capacity? Form letters? I don't know. How are these businesses or people using AI?
Certainly. So it looks here like the vast majority of use cases for AI are coming in at basic office productivity type tasks, which make a great deal of sense. The simplest tasks to automate away are those that are somewhat repetitive. But again, you still need that human in the loop there because they aren't 100% perfect, but they can be used as well for things like research. As both a research item here and a personal anecdote, AI tools are incredibly useful for things like literature reviews, which can take scholars or industry experts, you know, tens of hours to compile. An AI tool can do it for you in seconds. You still need to review it. I had a memorable experience a couple of weeks ago where a lengthy literature review was completed by AI, and when I reviewed it, almost everything was perfect, but it had made up one paper in the middle of it. If I hadn't reviewed that, that would have been quite a problem. That said, it still saved me, even with the review time, an enormous amount of time. So it is becoming more useful for tasks outside of just the basic, easy-to-automate functions. But that human-in-the-loop element is absolutely critical. And that's where humans who are accustomed to working with AI, who know how to prompt AI and know how to review its outputs, those skills are going to become very, very important in the coming years and are already becoming important in some industries today.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. So it's not using AI, but it's knowing how to use it, to catch it, to augment, but not to replace, at least hopefully. What do you say to the skeptics about that, though? I don't know if skeptics is the right word, but the people who are worried, though, that this is just going to eliminate a lot of jobs.
So the key element here is that there are certain jobs that may be able to, in the longer run, be more automated than others. But when you automate away a role, you don't just eliminate a job. You know, there's aggregate demand in the economy. It means that you're freeing up workers to do more interesting tasks. You know, when you free up filing clerks a few decades ago with the advent of computer storage systems, you tend to get more interesting jobs as a result because you can more efficiently store files. If we're able to save certain research costs, for example, or admin costs as a result of AI, that frees up human labor for other tasks, which tend to pay better because they tend to be at higher levels of productivity. Moreover, this augmented productivity tends to be good for wages. You know, wages tend to be tied to the level of productivity of workers. And we have a number of reports. For example, a PricewaterhouseCoopers report estimates that global GDP will increase by about 26% by 2030. And a huge fraction of this, as a result of AI adoption, that is, and a huge fraction of this, $6.6 trillion, is expected to come from the productivity angle. And those $6.6 trillion in increased productivity, that'll be tied in significantly to rising wages.
Trevor Wegener is the chief economist and director of the Research Center at the Computer and Communications Industry Association. Google that. It's fascinating information. CCIANet.org. CCIANet.org. Trevor, we'll visit with you more another day. Interesting stuff. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.